Just let me say, I got called about 2 o'clock this afternoon and asked if I could give a talk because the person who's scheduled to give a talk couldn't make it. So it isn't like I have this extensive set of notes to go from. It's going to be more like a lot of my talks, stream of consciousness. And I did print out a whole lot of things, which I probably won't use, but they're there in case of emergency. So the title of the talk, was anybody here for my talk, the Art of Living at Peace in Here and Now? One person, okay. Two people, wow. So I apologize to you in advance because this is going to be a very similar talk and it was given under very similar circumstances. I'm actually teaching a course called The Art of Living at Peace in Here and Now based on a book by Thich Nhat Hanh. And can everyone hear me okay? Right. When I practiced the Zen tradition, we used to do walking meditation together. Everything in Zen is a group, even showers. not the same stall, but they tell you showers in, showers out, and you scurry back to the Zen center. And so we would do walking meditation, and we'd chant together as a group, present moment, only moment, peace, calm. And we actually coordinate the chanting with the walking. So the left foot was present moment, right foot was only moment, left foot peace, right foot calm. And I think it's really, whether you're new or whether you've been practicing for a long time, both in formal practice and daily life, it's really a beautiful mantra. What else can we be at peace right now? And if we focus our intention to be at peace, we're much more likely to be there than if we're just running around being upset about something somebody said or somebody blew their horn at you or whatever it is that causes some sort of disturbance. And for those of you who don't know Thich Nhat Hanh, he really is... teaches in the Zen tradition, but a lot of his teaching has shades of this tradition. In a sense, it's Zen's more existential. This tradition tends to be somewhat more psychological and therefore much more appealing to Westerners than I think a lot of Zen is. But you know, Thich Nhat Hanh really, he said, this is our job, to be at peace. This is the whole purpose of doing this practice. And not to be awakened, not to be a bodhisattva, but to be at peace. And then from that place, he acts. I mean, as you know, he's been immensely, just made immense contributions to this world. And he's done it from a place of peace. The way he would see things is that if you're at peace, you will naturally do skillful things in the world rather than having some agenda, you should do this, you should be like this type sort of thing. I think an interesting question is to ask yourself right now, are you at peace? And what does that mean to you? There's a physical component to it. You might actually kind of, as you go through your life, explore whether you're at peace or not physically. Maybe you're going out and done something very active physically. How does it feel while you're doing it? Maybe you're a runner. When my body was younger, I used to get nice runner highs. It doesn't last forever, but it's really a nice place to be. Or what's it like after you've been really active physically and then you stop to really explore that? Or, you know, what it's like to maybe have been really upset emotionally and then it comes to an end somehow. It always does. I mean, look at whatever's happened to you. All these dramas that have occurred, where are they right now? So just explore what is it like when the drama is not occurring? That's the emotional component of peace. When I had a lot more testosterone my wife and I used to have a little bit more passion, which actually gets translated as suffering, by the way. That's the root of the word passion. I just go sit and be with the charge of the emotion. And after a while, it would sort of just being in the body and being with the breathing, it would calm down, come to an end. And then there was a sense of ease, a sense of peace about it. And then I could go back and we could have a dialogue from a very different place. Mentally, thoughts, do they lead to peace or not? I mean, it's really an interesting question. You know, we have all these thoughts. A lot of them are just like, you know, this person said this to me, and I can't believe they said that, and da, da, da. I mean, I've been noticing, and sometimes the thoughts just bubble up. They're just like patterns of behavior. I've been noticing for myself that just that sort of totally unprovoked moments, the mind starts thinking about this person and how I really don't think they're behaving very skillfully, and you know, I don't know if I want to engage with them or not, and maybe I should talk to them. And the thoughts just go all on their own, and it's like I can't really do anything about it. I mean, what I do sometimes is I reflect on this person's really good qualities. They have a lot of good ones, you know. Or I can reflect on these thoughts really aren't very helpful, but I don't try and push them away. I just let them have their life and don't claim them as me. They're little bubbles of concepts that sort of blip around, right? And if we pay attention to them, take them seriously, they cause all kinds of problems. In this class, I met a few people downstairs before the talk, and I say, hi, how are you? And then I say, are you at peace? And I really had people asking this question in the class. We were halfway through an 8-week course now. And it's like, you know, just ask yourself all the time, are you at peace or not? So one person who, a long-term practitioner, said, it's really helpful. I do these little things that, you know, I'll use the word stupid, but it's really just things human beings do as part of being human. So I start doing them now. And then I ask myself, am I at peace? And then rather than this whole flow of judgments about how I should be, or I should have known better and all this sort of thing, it just changes the whole orientation. So this week I was making, I'm kind of a coffee fanatic. I mean, I don't drink a lot of coffee, but I make one really good cup every day. And so I do pour over, and I was, you know, pouring a coffee, and I wasn't feeling very well, and I bumped the pour over thing and went all over the counter, coffee grinds all over the counter, and then slid down the side of the cabinets all over the floor. And, you know, I just said, are you at peace right now? And it just changed the whole way. So you just kind of peacefully wipe it up. That's all. Just a human being doing their thing. Accidents happen. So I think, you know, asking yourself whether you're at peace, and then if you're not, to ask yourself why not. What's going on that you're not at ease with? So I remember working with someone, actually I've been working with someone for, I don't know, 20 years or so. And for a long time she told me, you know, if I just get in a relationship, I'll be at peace, you know. And she did get a relationship, and then it was, well, if I just got a better relationship, I'd be at peace, you know. And then it was like, if I get a job, you know, and then it's if I get, of course, a better job. You know, if we keep sort of laying out conditions for when we're going to be at peace, we'll really never be there. And I think what's really radical about this practice is that rather than trying to adjust the world to fit your view of how it should be, can we open to the world the way it is? Now, language gets used like a lot of times there's a word gets used, acceptance, which can be taken as resignation, But really, it means to receive the experience, to open to it. So maybe for some people, be a better word would be allow. Just allow the experience to be what it is. And from that allowing, and that involves really kind of being in the body, grounding yourself. If it's something really powerful, you might find parts of the body to feel okay. Noticing how the breathing is. So the intention is not to just, okay, it's like this, I give up, it doesn't matter, there's no self anyway. But the intention is to open up so you can have some understanding of it, of what's going on. And it was interesting today, a discussion came up, and I teach this class during the daytime. A person who teaches graphic arts talked about how she got asked to teach a course that's outside of her usual place she teaches. And she had taught that course at the same institution before, and it was, for her perspective, a disaster. You know, her perception was that the students were passive-aggressive, and that then they go to this other teacher who would say, well, just stick with it, bear with it, and get through the course, which, of course, wasn't very helpful either. And so she's just wrestling this whole battle within herself of, well, it would really be good if I taught this course because I'd make some money, da-da-da, but I really don't want to have all this stuff happen to me again. And so she raised the question, and I said, well, and part of the practice suggestions for this week was, rather than trying to fix things, bring a quality of compassion to it, a quality of caring. Compassion is quality of responding to suffering and wanting to help. And so I said, well, how about if you, instead of trying to think this all out, ask yourself if you can care for this part of you that feels so troubled by this experience. Ask if there's something bigger that can hold it all. So in Buddhism, sometimes we have these patterns of behavior. Sometimes that's actually referred to as karma. Our actions create a tendency to act that way in the future. And so over our history, we've developed all kinds of patterns, some of them which are not very skillful. And part of releasing those difficult patterns is learning to be with them and to care for them. And I could really identify with this person because, you know, the thought just goes on all on its own. And I remember I was practicing at the Forest Refuge, and I had this, I don't like to use these words, but I don't know what else to use. I had this real awakening experience, this profound experience that happened. And that there was really nothing to do. And I would tell the teachers, oh, I'm just not doing anything. I'm just sitting in stillness at peace. And they were great. They were really totally supportive. And then a new set of teachers came in because they change every month. And this teacher thought I was totally deluded. And I thought, well, I'm leaving next week, so I don't get to struggle with her. And then she put a little sign up on the bulletin board asking if I'd like to talk. And boy, as soon as she did that, man, the mind just started running. I'm going to straighten her out, da-da-da. And I sent a note to Narayan asking her about what she had to say. She said, no, you're right, just straight ahead. And you know, I've really done a lot of work with powerful emotions. And I thought I knew what to do. I ground myself in the body. I'd widen the attention, pay attention to the breathing process. Boy, that mind was just going 100 miles an hour. Blah, blah, blah. So then I try and do walking meditation. So these are actually suggestions for practice that work a lot of times. Okay. So I just go walk rhythmically, not necessarily slow walking, but just going outside walking. It's still going. And then something just really organic happened. There's something bigger that just turned to that part that was all upset And it's this defender part I have. A lot of bad things happened to me as a kid. And so there's a part of me like, you aren't going to over me, right? It's just doom. And so that part just came up, and that big something big came up, and it just said, how hard it must be to play that role all the time. It just really brought a quality of care to it rather than trying to get rid of it. And then it just quieted down. It just said, you're okay right now. So there's actually a teaching, a form of therapy called internal family systems, which is look at all these qualities, what in Buddhism might be called sankharas or programs or little patterns of behavior as parts of yourself. And there's some big part that can take care of it. So that's just some ways to kind of work with this. There's a Chan master, which is a Chinese version of Zen, named Lin Qi, and his Japanese name is Rinzai. Rinzai Zen is a form of Zen where you're asked koans, questions that don't have an intellectual answer. And the intention of that is to get you out of your head. All these concepts we form, manipulate, da-da-da. Lin Qi had no patience for that at all. You know, all these ideas about becoming an awakened person or being a bodhisattva, he just had no interest in that. He said, our job is not to be an arahant, which in this tradition is an awakened person, or a bodhisattva. Our job is to be a busyness-less person. And what he meant by being a busyness-less person is not having something in front of you, to be here right now with what you're doing. So how much of this suffering, stress, and dissatisfaction is about something you think you need to accomplish, or something that might happen to you in the future, or about some thoughts about the past, and the mind's just kind of running around all the time, creating all kinds of problems. So that topic came up as well today. Long-term practitioners, I mean, 25, 30 years. And, you know, one guy said, well, you know, I just notice I'm thinking all the time. And so we talked about it a little bit, and he doesn't notice it till after the fact that he's been doing it. And another person who has been meditating, who I know has had some really great experiences, so I notice at the end of my sitting when I have a timer because I have to go someplace, that when the bell rings, I'm really not present at all. I'm lost in thought. But all those thoughts cause all kinds of problems. So really, I think if you walked out of here with one thing, is make an effort to be more embodied and to really to be a busyness-less person, to take each moment and really look at it as something precious. It's the only moment we have. And all these things about some future we have, that things are going to be okay, or da-da, or, you know, the thoughts that occur up in my mind about this particular person that are all in the past, what's actually happening now? And sometimes all you can do with what's actually happening now is to be with a difficult experience. And I think it's an interesting question, can there be peace when there's a difficult experience? Because we always have them. I mean, that's the core teaching of Buddhism, is that everything's impermanent, so you can't line it up. Olivia Hobblesdale, who gave a talk, it's on the I guess it's 2018, it's called Liberating Insights. And she talked about how she wanted to practice with an enlightened teacher. And she knew someone who knew this Tibetan teacher in the Boston area who was supposedly fully enlightened. And she talked about how she met with him, and they were sitting on the porch together, and she described in great detail, you know, what the porch was like and all that sort of thing. And he taught her about impermanence. And she thought, I wanted something more profound than that. She thought, I know impermanence. And then her partner, Hobbs, who used to teach here, got Alzheimer's, early onset Alzheimer's. And Hobbs was about, I think, 12, 14 years older than Olivia. And then she had become a caretaker. Every day she was dealing with this decline of her husband and having to deal with the changes that were taking place. And she said, then I really started understanding impermanence. She said, you know, it was something in her bones. And then she said, yeah, at some point I just surrendered to it. And it was just immense peace. And there's this real immense peace that, okay, we can be with this right now. Or maybe we're looking, I guess I remember I was going through a time when my son was in the hospital and I didn't know what was going to happen to him. And at first I was really kind of still and at peace. And then I got sick. I finally just said, okay, maybe I can't cope, so I just won't cope. I mean, don't we have all these ideas about what it's going to be like? And it's just very peaceful just to like, okay, I mean, this body's going to fall apart. Maybe this mind's going to, I'd like to go before the mind falls apart, but it might fall apart before that. So can we really open to that really insubstantial nature of things? And is there something that really can be at peace in the middle of all this? That's an inquiry. It's something that Olivia found. And she said, you know, she would acknowledge she's not there all the time. I don't think there's anybody there all the time. I think, you know, if the kind of one of the greatest dangers that we've talked about, this group gets together for lunch after a thing, is the idea that somehow we're going to come here and never have any problems anymore. Find me somebody who's like that. I really would like to meet them. Ajahn Chah, who was a Thai forest master who taught a lot of the senior teachers who are starting to retire now, he got diabetes. And he was paralyzed the last 10 years of his life, and about 5 years of it, he really couldn't speak at all. And a monk said to him, well, it's all empty. So emptiness is like the kind of piece de resistance of Buddhist teaching. In Theravada tradition, we tend to talk about not self, that you can't find anything that's permanent and constant, that's permanent, reliable, don't cling to anything that's changing. Don't call any of those things a self. It doesn't say whether it's a self or not in Theravada tradition. It just says anything, don't cling to things that are inconstant and unreliable. Which, what are what? The body, perceptions, views about the future, views about the past, pleasant, unpleasant experiences, thoughts, emotions. They're all inconstant, unreliable. We can't line it up. So that's the Theravada tradition. But emptiness is bigger. It's like, the Theravada tradition kind of looks as what we are, as the coming together of form, this physical body, of these pleasant and unpleasant experiences, of perceptions, of thoughts and emotions, and something that knows them. That's what consciousness is. But in the Mahayana tradition, which is basically Zen Tibetan tradition, that even the body isn't, there isn't a body. I mean, what is the body? It's a concept, right? If you look at the body, well, there's organs, heart, liver, bones, blood. And you go down a little farther, there are molecules. And you go down a little further, there are atoms. And you go down further, there are quarks. And who knows, after a while, you just... So emptiness is like they're just conditions. Nothing's solid. Nothing has any inherent existence. It's not that things don't exist, but they don't exist the way you think they do. It's kind of like a rainbow. You know, if you look at a rainbow, it sort of looks like something you could go to, but really it's just the coming together of moisture and lighting in a particular way, a particular angle. In the same way, the sense of identity, all that sort of stuff, is the coming together of all these components. So this monk was saying it's all empty. You know, it's just like a rainbow. And Ajahn Chah says it's harder than you think. Narayan's last teacher was a Chan teacher, Sheng Yen, Master Sheng Yen. His dying words: busily doing nothing, growing old, in emptiness, weeping, laughing, intrinsically there is no self, no one to die. So he's knowing about this emptiness, but he isn't denying that we have emotions, that we're human and vulnerable. So, you know, in Buddhism we talk about the two wings of Buddhism. One is wisdom. Wisdom is this not-self or emptiness view of the world. And the other is compassion. So there might not be any solid thing here, but there is an appearance of a human being, and it has thoughts and emotions, pain. They're vulnerable. We're vulnerable creatures. And so it's to hold both. It's to know in some level that this is all a dream. And I remember listening, well, very early in my talk, my practice, I went to listen to some Tibetan teacher at the Unitarian Church up in Harvard Square. He's talking about it all being a dream. And then someone said, well, if it's all a dream, why does it matter? And he said, well, you're in the dream. But we can shape the dream. We can shape how we look at things. So, one way we tend to look at things is that, we want to be loved, we want to be at peace, we want to be appreciated, we want people to be kind to us and do the same. But the world's not like that, is it? You know, the world is one of dissonance. Things, this social, political stuff that's going on is disturbing. There, people aren't kind all the time. In fact, there's a lot of greed and ill will going on. And so every time that happens, if you take the view that life should be the way you'd like it to be, that people should be kind to you, love you, da da, every time that doesn't happen, there's a reactivity to it. There's something's wrong. But suppose instead you shift it. This is the reality of things. There's kind of a chaotic nature to life. And can I be at peace with that? It's not that we shouldn't do anything about it, but we shouldn't be surprised when this stuff happens. And can we find a way to be with that? So that this constant activity to line things up is there's a Pali word, tanha, which usually often gets translated as desire, which is not a good translation. Craving is a little bit better. It's kind of a reflex action. You know, someone says something to you mean and boom, you know, it just happens. It's not like, because craving is the cause of suffering in Buddhism. It's this wanting things to be a certain way. And just notice as you go through life, all this tension gets created about trying to line things up and to be someone, to be approved, to have comfort. There's kind of I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. I mean, you certainly is a skillful way to do it. You want to take care of your body and all that sort of thing. But to realize that it just isn't going to line up all the time because things are inconstant, unreliable. And to find a way that can you open to that. So I think it's an interesting question to hold. In this tradition, the way one gets taught to hold this more is to see the changing nature of things, to really get it in your bones that everything is inconstant and unreliable. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is, Sutta is a discourse, Satipatthana means something like presence of mindfulness or like that, it has four places established mindfulness. The first is the body. The second is something called vedana, which is just, it's sometimes used to translate as feeling tone. It's not emotions. It's just pleasant, unpleasant experiences. And a third is thought and emotions. And in that discourse, the teaching is to observe that those established in mindfulness are constantly changing. To really see and so this is kind of a meditation practice, rather than just sitting trying to be calm, sitting to know that things are changing all the time. Maybe, I was sitting up here doing the sitting before class, before this talk, and I was sitting really very relaxed, feeling good, not thinking about what I was going to say now. And then I needed to cough, and I didn't really want to cough and disturb anybody, so then, okay, can you be at peace with that? And then, okay, fine. Coughing's kind of, it's not even a voluntary action. Actually, cough a little bit. Then the nose started running a little bit, It's like that, isn't it? I mean, you just can't line it up. But then I could, okay. And I have to admit, last 5 minutes, I was thinking, God, this nose is running. Should I reach over and grab a Kleenex? you really start seeing this in your bone. You start, the meditation is actually starting to see how things are changing. As you go through your life, see how things are changing all the time. It just takes some of the power out of it. And the intention is to, the language that gets used is somewhat to be dispassionate, because passion is suffering. But it doesn't mean you don't care. It's more like having more openness to things. Because if you notice, if you really get hooked up on one of these, the body or pleasant, unpleasant experience or emotion, thoughts or emotions, if you really grab onto, which is clinging, which is supposedly the cause of dukkha, it makes it worse. So the idea is to see if we can just learn to let it flow through us. And the dispassion is kind of seeing that this isn't going to stay. I'm furious right now, but I can be with this and I can watch it and it'll go away eventually. Or, it's really great now. Like the first part of the sitting was really great, but it's not going to last. It doesn't mean that you don't enjoy it. It just means that when it's gone, there's not this kind of disturbance like, oh God, the nose is running. It's just like, okay, this is how it is right now. So it's kind of like not being so pushed and pulled around by sense experience. And that's so much of what this practice is about. To sit and observe the changing behavior. And the reason that we kind of try and settle the mind on something, it could be the breathing process or a mantra, metta practice, whatever works for you, is to calm it down enough so it can see. And the sitting is actually a way to a container to allow us to observe these things so that we can go out in life and see the same kind of thing. So I've been kind of playing around with this question of... about whether there's something that's at peace in the middle of all this. And... I talked a little bit about this woman in my own experience where something just came up organically and held the experience. So Ajahn Sumedho, who founded a couple monasteries in England, said he actually thought the Theravada tradition focused too much on the objects. So there's a sense of me watching the objects. And we're trying to see through the sense of identity. And yet, here's this observer watching all this stuff happens. Is that what you are? And so his teaching would be, notice the awareness itself. What is it that's aware? And this is kind of a koan to hold. There's something that simply knows. It doesn't take any effort at all. Does it take any effort to hear these words? No, it just happens, right? Of course, if the mind is somewhere else, you won't hear them. But the awareness is always there. And so this part of this something that there is something. You know, it's like it isn't that all things are impermanent. The Buddhist teaching is all conditioned things are impermanent, which implies that there's something unconditioned that's at peace. And that unconditioned is this awareness that's simply present, holds everything, doesn't have opinions or views, doesn't try and resolve and fix things. Because when you're trying to resolve and fix things, what is it? One part of mind fighting the other part of mind, right? I should do this, but then you don't. Because if you know, it's like with me, it's eating. Like, you know, when I'm really kind of uncomfortable, I sort of want to go have a little bit of something, right? And then the other part of me is saying, well, you know, you're really better if you didn't do that. But then this part that doesn't like discomfort just says, yeah. So can you just watch it and not struggle with the whole process? Is it just an investigation to take that on? I talked a little bit about a lot of this practice is about being wise view, about the way we look at things. So, and part of looking at things is to realize that this world is one of dissonance, that things happen, and not to be surprised by them so much, that it shouldn't be. And people talk about, things are so bad this day. They've never been so bad. Well, my parents lived through 2 world wars and a depression. FDR, who I thought was really, I approve of what he did as a president, but he tried to stack the Supreme Court. I mean, this has been going on forever. And so I think it's to kind of realize that this is kind of the nature of things, not that we want it to be that way or we shouldn't try to do something about it, but to get all spun up about the whole thing, I don't see it as helpful. Could we move in a place of peace to act on that? So part of wise view, which is the first path factor. So in Buddhism, there's dukkha, which usually translates suffering, but it's really not a very good translation. Sometimes stress, dissatisfaction. But dukkha really is the sense, that the really refined sense of what Buddha was talking about bringing to an end was a sense of someone separate from the experience. The sense of me that this is all happening to. Because, he talks about, I'll just read a little bit from the... I'll actually use my notes for a second here. He says, birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha, association with the unbeloved is dukkha, separation from the loved is dukkha, not getting what one wants is dukkha. In short, the 5 aggregates of clinging are dukkha. Well, we're all going to die. We're all going to get old. We'll all have illness. Although in the elders group, this one woman claimed that she was never going to get ill. And I said, how about the K? And she denied that too. And I resisted temptation to say, you mean to tell me you think your body's the same as it was when you were 22 or something? She's like 70 years old, right? So he isn't saying that we can end these things. This is the reality of being human. What he's saying is we can bring to an end the sense of someone that this is all happening to. This is an idea. So wise view, in part, wise view is having this view that of not self, of emptiness. That's the really kind of lofty wise view. There's also a wise view, which is sometimes called mundane wise view. And that's to see that there's causality. And that when we act certain ways, they lead to peace, more peace. and we act out of ways, they lead to dissatisfaction, etc. And so the we have a lot of patterns of behavior that have been learned through time. And we are the way we are right here, right now. In fact, in some ways, you have no choice. You're born with a particular set of parents, a set of genes. Things happen to you. You're in a culture, and you are just the way you are. You couldn't be any other way. So there's a quote I love by Shunryu Suzuki, who was a Japanese Zen master taught on the West Coast, and he's a beautiful book I've probably read 10 times. I've looked at it for a while, called, what is it called? Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. It's really profound. I mean, you don't even realize how profound it is for a long time. And he gave a talk one time, and he said, each of you is perfect just the way you are. And it's true, right? We couldn't be any other way. And how does that shift things about the way you see yourself and the way you act? I should be this or I should be that. You're just perfect. You couldn't be any other way. So I actually use this practice a lot. I go to stores and I see people, and rather than looking at how they dress or how they act, I just think to myself, perfect, just the way they are. And then I just say, may you be well. And, you know, it just, it's like everybody feels like a friend. Try it sometime. Look at me as perfect. Don't judge my talk. Couldn't be any other way, you know. And then he said, and there's room for improvement. And what he meant by that was that we have a little wiggle room. There are these patterns of behavior that it's not our fault they're there, but we can pause and ask whether it's going to bring more peace or not. And in the Buddhist teaching, the things that bring more peace are kindness, compassion, renunciation, which sounds like a terrible word to the Westerners, but when you don't need so much, isn't it more peaceful? So I think I'll stop there, and I hope something I've said has been helpful. Ajahn Sucitto once said, if you say enough things, certainly one thing will be good. And just really to invite you to ask questions about your own life. And if you're not at peace, let's maybe investigate it together, okay?